So today is June 13th, 2023. I'm David Caruso, here with Tim Krogan, Sue Krogan, and also Matt Krogan. We're conducting an oral history interview here at the Science History Institute. Thank you again for sitting down with me and telling me a little bit about your life. And like I said, I want to start at the very beginning. So I know you were born in Santa Cruz, California, or I should ask, were you born and raised in Santa Cruz, California?
Yes.
Okay. And that was 1950?
Yes, exactly. Okay.
Can you tell me a little bit about your parents? What were they like? What were their names? Did they work? What were their occupations?
Yeah, both my parents worked. So my dad's name was Claire Malloy Krogan. Mm-hmm. And my mom's name was Mabel Wilson Krogan. Mm-hmm.
Were they native to the Santa Cruz area, or did they move there at some point?
I guess they moved there. I'm not.
What do you? Yeah, they had both been.
They were born
in the Midwest. Pete in South Dakota and Mabel in Illinois, and then had spent their youth in Southern California, and both graduated from UC Berkeley. Mm-hmm. Got married while they were in college. And then moved to Santa Cruz upon graduation.
Okay. Do you know what they were studying in college?
Yeah, Pete, mechanical engineering, okay. And Mabel was bacteriology.
Okay. Perfect. Bacteriology, great. So what are some of your earliest memories of growing up in Santa Cruz? What was your neighborhood like? What was your home like?
Oh, I guess the earliest memories are going at the beach. Mm-hmm. The home seemed very large at the time. I don't know, in retrospect now, it may not be that large. Mm-hmm. It was a nice family. It was a, we got along well. I guess that's pretty much covers it, unless you want me to try to come up with more.
Oh, no, I have some other questions I can ask.
Okay.
So your father was a mechanical engineer, your mother bacteriology.
Yes, yeah. She worked ultimately in hospitals, mm-hmm. as a microbiologist.
Okay, yeah. And so that's what I was going to ask. So your parents both worked when you were young?
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
Did you have someone who sat for you while they were at work?
Yeah, various people.
Various people.
Yeah, so, over the time.
So hired nannies and
yes.
things like that.
Mm-hmm.
What do you recall any interests that you had when you were very young? Were you out in the yard looking for bugs? Did you like reading? Were you interested in music? I'm trying to remember when I was given a chemistry set when I was a kid. I was probably like 4 or 5 when they shouldn't have given me a chemistry kit. But I mean, did you have? What were some of your early interests, if you remember any specifically?
Oh, I liked to be outdoors. Wasn't into sports very heavily. Mm-hmm. I did participate, but I wasn't very gung-ho on it. Tried a little bit of piano lessons, that kind of thing, mm-hmm. when I was younger. But I had an older brother who was a superb pianist, so there was kind of a model there. But mm-hmm. I didn't have the skills he did. Mm-hmm. So, like to go hiking in the hills around Santa Cruz. Mm-hmm. Like the outdoors a lot.
And how much older is your older brother?
How old is Jack?
About 10 years.
10 years. 8 years older than Tim.
8 years older.
8 years older. So he was already in elementary school when you were born.
Right.
So middle school when you were in elementary school.
Right.
Roughly. Okay.
Exactly.
Do you recall doing a lot with your brother when you were young? Was he playing with you, or is he one of the, you're my younger brother, stay out of my room?
Probably a compromise between those
compromise.
Two.
Okay.
We shared a bedroom, so there's some interaction there.
His parents, so I had Jack and then Kate. And then they were having difficulty having more children, and so they adopted Shelley.
Mm-hmm.
And then she got pregnant with Pete. Tim. And so Tim and Shelley were very close in growing up because they were close in age.
Yeah.
What's the age difference?
Was it 13 months or
something?
Yeah. Oh, wow.
A year-ish.
Okay.
Just about.
And then there was another long break before Matt and Mary came.
9-year gap.
Yeah.
And then my sister Marion and me.
Yeah. Okay. So relatively large family over time.
Right.
Right. While growing up in the household, when your parents weren't at work, what did you tend to do as a family? Was this when you were going on the hikes outside, or were there other things that your family did together as a group?
Well, we regularly took vacations, so that was kind of a highlight each year. We go out camping. I guess we must have stayed at a motel once or twice, but in general, it's all the camping. Mostly to save money, because that was an issue.
And did you stay in California, or did you travel, go
mostly
on road trips?
Mostly in California.
Mostly in California.
Yeah. And when did you move to Marin?
What's that?
When did you move to Marin?
That was when did you move?
Are you gonna, we'll get into the future.
Sure.
I think he stayed in Santa Cruz till you were about 7 or something.
Yeah.
Santa Cruz till 7.
Mm-hmm. Or actually maybe not that long. 50. Yeah, I know these dates if you want me to state it. So.
Oh, go ahead.
When? Sure. So, Tim was born in 1950, then in 1954 about, our dad decided to go to seminary and become a Presbyterian minister and went to San Francisco Theological Seminary, which is in Marin County in San Anselmo, and moved the family of he and Mabel plus 4 kids to there, and they lived in married student housing while he spent 3 years in seminary. And then Mabel, believe, raised the kids and worked as a medical microbiologist while he studied, and kind of got rewired to work pretty much 20 hours a day. So she was sort of, you know, this incredible woman of, she could sleep 4 or 5 hours a day, day after day after day, and be completely happy and fine. So interesting gal. And then my dad got his first job as a minister, as essentially a missionary pastor to Kansas, where he moved into a town where there was no Presbyterian church, and he recruited the members,
and physically built
the church. He knew how to do construction.
He had an engineering degree.
Yeah, and from his mechanical engineering degree. And then he'd worked for a construction firm in in Santa Cruz. And then after 3 years in Kansas or so, 3 to 4 years, couldn't really stand the weather. Loved the people, but the weather drove him crazy. He loved Santa Cruz weather, SoCal weather, and positioned opened up in Novato, California, N-O-V-A-T-O, in Marin County. And moved the family there. And so I was born, Mary and I were born in Kansas, but when we were young, we moved to Novato and were raised in Novato.
Okay. That helps fill in a lot of the history. So you were back in California roughly what year?
61.
1961. Okay, so you were 11 years old when you were back in California. One of the other questions that I was going to ask about your childhood was whether or not, and so this, the answer is pretty obvious at this point, but whether or not your family was religious at all.
Yeah, my dad was a minister.
And so before your father decided to become a pastor, was religion a strong component of what you did on a regular basis? Were you going to services? Were you being raised?
I guess so. I haven't really reflected on the very early on.
They were active in the First Presbyterian Church of Santa Cruz, I think.
Okay.
And
so I would say religion was a significant part of the family's
And life. Did your father ever speak about why he decided to become a minister, why he wanted to move in that direction instead of remaining an engineer?
Never heard why. He was an excellent pastor, quite successful at it.
Yeah. He was well-liked.
Well-liked, and he successfully recruited and started that church, and it was in Augusta, Kansas.
Mm-hmm. A place with many 13 churches already, I think, 5,000 people. Mm-hmm.
So they were disappointed when he left. The congregation loved him. And then in Novato, quite successful, probably doubled or tripled the size of the church in Novato. Mm-hmm. He was the senior pastor. And we were raised as pastor's kids in Novato, and our dad was very popular, so it was a kind of a special way to grow up.
Yeah.
When the town all loves your dad. Mm. Yeah.
So when you were in Kansas, you were roughly 8 years old. Do you recall what life was like for you while your father was literally working to build the church there?
Yeah, a lot of open area. This is how I remember it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the weather changes, you know, in winter with the snow.
Tell
and
them
stuff.
About the tornado.
Oh, yeah. And then we had, when a tornado watch would be called, we'd all go down to the, it was a split level. So there was half of it, of one level was underground. And there's a certain corner of the house we kind of all not cram into, but get seated at. On the floor, and we'd wait for the activity outside to play out. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that answers that.
Yeah.
And didn't you, one time your parents weren't home and you had to get met and married down there or something?
I'm sure I did. Yeah.
Wrangling up the little kids to get them to safety.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Younger.
And your dad made you work, remember? Dig?
Oh, yeah, around the house. Yeah, pretty intense laboring obligations.
What sort of obligation?
Oh, indoors and outdoors, anything that needed to be done.
Setting up chairs in the church.
Yeah, yeah, helping move chairs, put up chairs for the services every Sunday at the church, and then taking them down after the service was over, stacking them up and helping move them back into storage.
In terms of building the church there, did your father have help from anyone else to do the manual labor? Did he involve the kids in doing
that
work?
It was professionally built.
Okay.
It was built by a contractor, but since he was an engineer, he was pretty heavily involved in the design and the specifics of the construction. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he didn't physically build it.
Okay.
He didn't physically build it.
Yeah.
No.
But he oversaw it.
Oversight management.
Exactly. That's correct.
Okay. Were you ever brought to the construction site that you recall to see the church being raised?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I'd go by on my own, mm-hmm. you know, as time went by, just to see it and play around it, you know, because mm-hmm. it was just kind of a fun, ongoing project to see.
You mentioned that you had a number of chores around the house, responsibilities.
Mm-hmm.
Did your father or your mother show you what you needed to do? Like, were they, I'm just reflecting on when I was a little kid and my parents would involve me, and if we needed to build something, mm-hmm. even if it was just like, I doubt I was really actually building anything. You know, I had a hammer in my hand or used a pair of pliers.
Right.
Were your parents showing you how to do these various chores, these life skills, or were you just expected to kind of figure it out?
Well, my dad had pretty high expectations, so if you were told to do something, he would check it, and if it wasn't done right, it would be done right before you were finished with it, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So, in that sense, he brought direction to the project.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess essentially, if you weren't going to do it right, you could expect repercussions.
Mm-hmm. He wouldn't necessarily give you a lot of instruction.
Yeah.
And, but he had a high standard, so it was a little tricky.
Yeah.
And to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
My mom would give us more instruction.
I would agree on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think both your parents had very high standards for all the children.
And those high standards, did they apply to Scholastics as well? Were you expected to do well in school?
Yes.
Were there any, and I know that you started elementary school in one location, switched schools, then switched schools again. In those early years of education, were there any specific subjects that you were more drawn to compared to others?
I'd have to think about that. Have I ever discussed
any other
area?
No.
No, life sciences was always of interest to me.
Mm-hmm.
So, something biological
always
drew me to it.
Do you recall any teachers from those early years that stood out as good educators, people that were getting you more interested?
So long ago, I can't remember their names.
Okay. He was much more involved high school level.
Yeah, part of the reason why I ask those series of questions is just thinking about 1950s U.S. when they're starting to think more deeply about investing in science education in the United States, and so I'm always curious to know how students at various ages were impacted or not by these changes in education. And sometimes you see or you hear about people who had PhDs that were teaching high school science, and so sometimes those individuals stand out. So if there are any teachers as we move along, if there are any teachers that stand out or science classes that really had an impact on you, I'd love to hear about those.
Okay. We can talk about that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And in these early years when your parents were home, maybe over dinner, maybe in the evenings when you're all relaxing, did they talk to all their kids about things that were going on more broadly in the world? Were you getting into debates about, this is McCarthy era and after, getting into debates about communism? Were you talking about religious beliefs or engaging in more discussions about religion or anything that was kind of a contemporary topic of the day?
I don't recall that. The religion was covered on a Sunday because you went to, you spent your whole Sunday morning at the church. So you went to the regular church service and you also went to the preceding child's service.
I think when you were in high school and in the 60s, your mom was very involved in politics.
PTA
and school
politics.
Board.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, more late 60s, 70s, more after Tim left.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
For college.
Just remember, a story about you had your hair long and your dad stood up for you one time. You went to some naval base for dinner or something?
Oh, yeah.
And your dad stood up for you because the guy didn't want you to come in.
Oh, was this Hamilton? Maybe?
Yeah, Hamilton. So there's an Air Force base at the edge of the town. And we went for a kind of a tour type thing, and this one guy was jacking me around about having longer hair. And my dad said, well, doesn't matter what his hair length is. He's an American citizen, so.
That was probably 1969 or 70.
Because mm-hmm.
Tim grew his hair quite long when he was a freshman in college.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe sophomore.
It was pushing my waistline.
Yeah.
By the end.
Yeah. That, yeah, okay, that is very long.
Yeah. Yeah. And our dad was a veteran from the Navy, mm-hmm. from World War II.
I'm not sure he was real pleased about my hair length.
Yeah, he probably wasn't thrilled, but he
but he didn't confront me. He didn't tell me, cut your hair.
Mm-hmm.
He was cutting my hair already, so he never said it had to be.
What would we over dinner? Sure. Well, we bless every meal, mm-hmm. so there was always the to start every meal, and we have different blessings that we
mm-hmm.
sometimes. caused some stress with the boyfriends or girlfriends of some of the kids, because they would memorize one and then we'd throw in a new one.
You guys sang after
Dinner? Sang the doxology. And then to our parents very much emphasized scholastics, music and public service, and didn't care much about sports. Mm-hmm. So if we played sports or did well in sports, it didn't really count for much. Mm-hmm. But
I agree.
Yeah, we were expected to, you know, maybe be in student government, to be good students, and ideally to be good musicians, but really only
Jack was.
Our oldest brother was an outstanding musician.
Accomplishment.
Probably about it.
Yeah.
Really.
And I guess he was, I mean, being 8 years older, so while you were in Kansas, he was getting ready to, almost ready to head off to college. I assume that
he never moved to Novato.
Okay.
So he went directly from living in Kansas to college. So I was born in November 1916. He was already in college.
Okay.
So we're 18 years separated.
Right.
So we were never, strictly speaking, two boys in the same household.
Mm-hmm. And do you recall what he went to college to study?
Chemistry.
Yes.
Sciences.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then he ended up in med school.
Yeah. Then he ended up as a
MD.
MD.
Okay.
So he went to KU med school.
Okay. Yeah. Chemistry.
So in addition to discussing religion around the house, and your father, right, mechanical engineer, expectations in terms of being able to do certain chores and work around the house, do you recall your mother ever talking to the kids about the work that she was doing in the life sciences? I don't know what she did in hospitals as a microbiologist. I don't know if she was analyzing slides or anything like that, but I'm wondering if she was introducing any of you to the kind of work that
Mary
she was doing.
Mary said that she would rope you guys into going into the lab and helping her.
Yeah. So for me, I don't know about you, Tim, but she was working full time and, you know, kind of watching us when we were little kids. Mm-hmm. And she was working actually overtime to help pay for the college of her older kids. So Jack's in college, Kate's in college.
Right.
So she would work, you know, an extra at least 10 hours a week, if not more, to try to build up kind of a college fund.
Pretty significant.
And so Mary and I were, you know, five or whatever, would go in the lab and I would do red blood cell counts. Mm. So she would analyze patient samples.
Right.
So red blood cell counts, white blood cell counts, you know, try to culture out bacteria to see if they had an infection, that sort of thing. So,
okay.
Yeah, I'm sure it would be considered completely out of line now.
Inappropriate.
That you have your kids handle patient samples from potentially infectious diseases. But it was a, you know, suburbia, Novato.
And you were under her immediate supervision.
Yeah. And we never did, as far as I know, we got sick from it.
Yeah, I didn't.
Yeah. So, but we all...
So there's some knowledge of what the type of work that she was doing.
Yeah, that's true.
First-hand knowledge.
One other question about this general time period. Do you recall Sputnik and hearing about the...
Yep.
Can you tell me a little bit about what you remember from the launch of Sputnik?
Oh, there was not an arms race, but a get in the space race.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I wanted to be a... astronaut because of all of that for quite a while. Remember that?
Yeah, I didn't know that, but yeah,
totally makes sense.
Yeah.
Did your family, do you recall your family reacting to it in any way? Because this is also the period of time, again, height of communism, people starting to build bomb shelters.
Yeah.
I don't know if maybe that became part of the culture of your, and also being in Kansas, probably not bad to have an underground shelter with the tornadoes, but... If there was any sort of political or other broader discussions of Sputnik.
That didn't seem to be an overbearing issue in the family.
Our parents our dad was like a moderate Republican,
right,
and our mom was
a little more liberal.
She was a Democrat, mostly liberal, moderate on some issues. Mm-hmm. So they differed politically.
Yeah.
She was pretty liberal when it came to things like the school board and women's rights. And
yeah, actually, she was more liberal with the school board than she was at home.
Yeah. She would have been called kind of a early women's liver.
Yeah, she was.
Trowell trying to get her dad to do half the housework was good luck with that. But he contributed somewhat. Mm-hmm. She was a really, really good cook, so her meals were delicious. And would be, I mean, he could only cook the most basic.
Yeah, he could.
A hot dog and pour cereal.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Maybe a fried egg.
Yeah, so.
And so given your mother's liberalism, or liberal.
Mostly.
Comparatively to.
Yeah.
Were the kids introduced to those things as well? Were the children, like both boys and girls, encouraged to cook and handle the what might have been considered more traditional women's work around the house? Was there, and were the girls also doing some of the traditional what might be considered men's work around the house?
By my age, they were. I did laundry and dishes.
Yeah, we did the whole slew. Whatever needed to be done.
You used to bribe Mary to do when you had to do dishes.
Yeah,
yeah.
I'd give her
pay
candy.
Her a dime.
Yeah,
not a penny, but a dime went a long way. You could get a candy bar for a dime.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And I think Mabel hoped that her daughters would have careers or go into science, possibly. You know?
Yeah, I think that was the unspoken expectation.
And the youngest daughter, Mary, did. So she's now provost at Davis.
Kate was a philosophy major. She almost got her PhD. She never finished her dissertation, I guess.
Right.
UC Berkeley?
Yeah, UC Berkeley.
Mm. Do you recall how it was transitioning for you going from Kansas back to California, switching school systems and meeting new people? Were there any challenges that you encountered with that?
I don't remember any obstacles. I think I really liked California right from the get-go. Mm-hmm.
Better weather,
for sure. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of baseball, which I was playing baseball then.
Okay. So were you playing baseball just for fun with kids in the street at ballparks, or were you joining a team?
Oh, it was a team.
It was a team.
Yeah, so the rec department organized, baseball games and set up a schedule and all that for teams to play against each other over the summer. Hmm.
And so when you came back to California, were you now in what would be the equivalent of junior high school?
Like 12.
11. Almost. 12.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Do you remember going to an elementary school in Novato?
Yeah, that one close to the house.
West Novato.
West Novato, I think just for a year or two.
Yeah, so you would have been sixth grade. And which was an elementary school.
Elementary school, and then 7-8 for middle, and then...
9th at the time, 7-8-9.
7-8-9 for middle school, and then high school is
10-11-12.
Okay. So you went to 1 year in elementary, then started middle school and then high school. Was the high school... How large was your high school?
It was big. I think it was 2,000
students. 2,000
students?
Mm-hmm. And do you know roughly how many... schools were pulling in for that high school? Like, was it three junior high schools, four junior high schools?
Oh, were? It was two.
It was two.
Two.
Okay.
Yeah.
But everyone, so the town that you were in, did you kind of know the kids that were coming from the other junior high school? Had you had interactions with them before meeting up in high school?
Maybe
through sports.
Sports. He would have played sports against them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Or with them.
Okay. Yeah.
And then they built another high school and another junior high.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Basically, they were finished about a little while after you left for college.
Right.
Okay. And that's where I went to school. It was more on the west end of town where we lived.
Mm-hmm.
So.
When you came back to California, this is the early 1960s, JFK presidency. This mm-hmm. is, you mentioned the space race, right? This mm-hmm. is,
right.
I forget what year specifically the Kennedy's, we choose to go to the moon speech, right? Not because yeah. Because it's hard, right?
Right.
I'm forgetting the words. Right.
And so you're now thinking that you want to be an astronaut, yeah, so you're totally. You have an interest in space.
Right.
This is also, kind of the beginning of the civil rights era. In the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot that is going on more broadly. With your interest in potentially becoming an astronaut,
mm-hmm.
Did this shift your interests in school at all? Were you becoming more heavily interested or heavily invested in science at that time? Or was this just a, you want to be an astronaut, you want to go into space, like a child?
More like that, more than I want to be an astronaut. Because mm-hmm. I ended up being pre-med as in high school,
oh.
so had to do all the science courses that were associated with that.
Do you recall what any of your science classes were like in middle school?
Well, this would have been actually in high school.
Right. I was just wondering if you remembered anything from the middle school era.
I think. I don't recall any.
Okay. So what year did you start high school?
1968.
That's
when I graduated, sorry.
So 1965 is when you started.
Right.
So you're going in, so that's 10th grade, right, as we said, 10th, 11th, 12th. When you started at your high school, do you recall what your curriculum was like at that point in time? Did you, I'm just thinking about my experience, I had math, I had English, I had history. I think in my first year we did biology as my science. Was that similar to, was that kind of, the kind of curriculum that you had?
Yes.
And in that first year at high school, do you recall any teachers that stood out in terms of being inspirational, also being jerks?
I don't remember being really in a position to evaluate them. Mm-hmm. I think kind of the family values were, I don't think you came home and badmouthed your teachers. What do you think?
No. Movado generally had good teachers.
Yeah.
It was not a really wealthy town. It was kind of middle class. So
yeah.
You didn't have, really advanced classes like some of the really wealthy towns in California.
Mm-hmm.
But solid. But say, it was probably in the 75th percentile for California as a school district, something like that.
Okay. While you were going to high school, you'd mentioned that your older brother went to college, your older sister went to college. I assume it was an expectation that you were going to be going to college as well?
I guess it was. It wasn't a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't in my face about it. I think they just everybody assumed they'd go.
Okay. And when you started, you mentioned earlier that you were pre-med in high school. Did your high school, was that an official designation that you had?
No.
Or is it that you were thinking that you wanted to
just
pursue?
Just being a doctor, like the route to go.
Is there a reason why you wanted to become a physician? No, I guess you stopped wanting to be an astronaut.
Yeah. No, it was a respectable position.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of like you had your ministers, they were respected, you had your doctors, they were respected, you had the police more or less respected depending on who you were,
mm-hmm.
and judges and stuff like that. So it was a good, respectable endeavor.
And I guess it also related to your family's commitment to service.
Yes,
I mean,
exactly.
Being a physician, healing individuals,
yeah,
caring for them.
I agree with that.
Okay.
And our brother, Jack, was held in
already,
very,
yeah.
held a very high regard.
Mm-hmm.
So,
in the family.
Right, kind of set up as the model, maybe. Mm-hmm. Eagle Scout and...
Right.
Med's parent.
You know, goes to med school, marries an heiress.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those are very high standards.
Exactly.
Not too many heiresses.
Yeah, that's
being in tough competition.
Mm-hmm. That's ticking off.
And a concert level pianist too, yeah.
Yeah, you were a scout and went to, what is it, they call it life, but you didn't quite make Eagle. But Jack
right.
made Eagle. Yeah.
Yes.
Right, exactly.
So had you been involved in Boy Scouts from a young age? I guess it's Cub Scouts, then Boy Scouts.
Yeah,
right? I went through
Cub
the
Scouts.
Same process.
Yeah, went through the whole stretch.
And I remember the kerchiefs. I don't remember, I think you got a different color.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? And then like when
yeah.
you moved on to Boy Scouts, you got the new uniform.
Yeah,
right.
I think I made it. I'm trying to remember the.
There's Cub Scouts, Wee Blows, and then Boy Scouts.
Wee Blows. I
yeah,
forgot
Wee
about
Blows.
Wee Blows. Then Boy Scouts, and then there was there's something then Life, then Eagle, if I remember.
Star.
Star.
Yeah, I think
Star
I made
Life,
it to
Eagle.
Life.
Oh, that's,
and I didn't make
close.
It to.
Yeah.
Yeah. It. So I started high school, and my commute it was a 2-hour commute to get to high school. So it's like that.
Two hours each way?
Yeah, it was New York City. I was on Staten Island, and I had to get to the Upper East Side of Manhattan. So it's 2 hours each way. So Boy Scouts. Not
in the
that was a premier high school.
Our kids had an hour. I thought that was bad. 2 hours is horrible.
Upper East Side.
Yeah. So you were involved in Boy Scouts. Is there a reason why you didn't make it to Eagle Scout? Did you lose interest?
Kind of lost interest.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of started falling by the wayside the older I got.
And while you were in high school, were you still playing team sports, baseball?
I always worked, so I had a newspaper route,
mm-hmm.
and so I couldn't stay around for practices and
okay.
stuff like that after school.
Okay.
So not much of that.
In high school, did you have any other... So you're working, you're studying, you're thinking of becoming a physician... Did you have any other hobbies or interests at that age?
Well, I ended up student body president at the school. I don't know if that came up already.
Hmm.
So that, I had a lot of fun with that, and that worked out very well, I thought, on both for everybody, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't have any real strong other activities, you know, that...
You liked hunting.
I liked hunting and fishing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
More hunting than fishing at that point.
Yeah.
So when had you? I assumed you were using a rifle.
Yeah, shotgun.
Shotgun. When had you learned how to shoot?
Let's see. Maybe in Boy Scouts, they.
Because your dad didn't hunt.
No.
Yeah, they would teach you to shoot a .22,
mm-hmm.
which is very small.
I remember getting my rifle re-badge
yeah.
at Boy
yeah,
Scout camp.
Yeah, exactly. So learn, and I was a good shot, so that was fun. And then I had friends who were hunters, so I just started going out with them hunting.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably, I know it wasn't the safest series of events. I can remember at one point meeting up with a guy out in the field, I was out hunting by myself, he was hunting by himself, but we recognized each other, because I knew he was a hunter, and I knew he hunted that area. We got together, and he was sitting about from here to the clock, and on one side of a little creek, and I was on the other side of the creek, and he was kind of messing around with his gun, and all of a sudden it went off, and right next to me, about this far away, went like this, so... He goes, ha, ha, ha. I jumped up. He was quite upset. It was too late for me to be upset. You know, it was over. So.
And he missed.
He missed.
So.
Yes. He missed.
The most important part.
Yeah. So
yes.
That was the closest call.
When you went out hunting, how long would you go out for? Was this?
Oh, I loved it. I'd go all morning.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed it. I don't do it. It was duck hunting.
Yeah.
Duck hunting.
Yeah.
Were these ever, you'd mentioned that your family would go on camping trips. Were you ever like out overnight? Go, like if you had a free weekend or over the summer,
yeah.
Did you go out for days on end on hunting trips or camping trips?
When I was much older, would do that as an adult, would go deer hunting some. Never shot a deer, but just for the fun of it, I'd go. Mm-hmm. I'd get up in the loft and, you know, wait for the deer to come by, but I never got a shot at any of them. Mm-hmm. I wasn't very gung-ho.
And you mentioned fishing as well, right?
Yeah, I love fishing. Yeah.
How often would you go out fishing? Same as hunting?
Well, we have a pond on our property now, mm-hmm. so I still do a lot of fishing. So, but there was a lake pretty close to the house in Kansas, so I'd go down there and I'd go down to the lake and go fishing. It was just about 3 blocks away, so it was very convenient.
Any of your siblings join you?
No, there was some I did by myself, I think. I don't remember them ever coming along.
And what about in California? Were you back in California? Were you still going out fishing?
Let's see. I think you went
fishing. I would join them sometimes.
You'd go fishing with me once in a while.
Yeah.
It wasn't a regular event, but we did get together on that.
We shot the shotgun together.
Yeah.
When I was pretty little. I was like 5 or 6, and Tim would stand behind me or sit. Yeah, we'd kind of crouch down and fire it off, and you somehow supported me that it all worked.
Got behind you and cushioned you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, I got this. Yeah, it was pretty unusual to shoot a shotgun with 5.
So while in high school, you're thinking about pursuing medicine as a career. Mm-hmm. At what point do you start thinking about what colleges you might want to go to?
It would have been towards the end of high school. There wasn't,
Kate was up at Reed.
Yeah, my sister Kate was at Reed College, mm-hmm. so, which is where I ended up going. But there wasn't a whole lot of talk around the family table or anything like that, like what school are you going to go to, and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It just didn't seem to be a big point of interest.
But were you aware of any other potential schools that you might want? I forget where your older brother went.
KU.
Kansas.
He was from Kansas. He was living in Kansas.
Living in Kansas. So Kansas. Yeah. So Kansas, Reed. Your parents were at Berkeley.
Right.
Were you aware of other schools that were out there? Were you thinking about even maybe moving?
Well, I visited my sister when she was at Reed, so I was pretty locked in.
Okay.
I thought that about was about as cool a place as I'd seen, anyway.
Do you recall what made you interested in Reed during that visit?
Well, it was slightly hippie, mm-hmm. yeah, which to me was kind of cutting edge, you know, especially compared to going to public high school and stuff like that. There were some a little bit hippie guys, but nothing like Reed College had, you know, mm-hmm. Just seemed like a different atmosphere.
Kate was in philosophy.
Yeah, she was in philosophy, my sister. Kinda... Mm-hmm.
And this is also when you had long hair.
Yeah, I had long hair then.
Do you recall why you wanted to grow your hair out?
I guess because it was stylish then.
Okay.
For lack of a better description.
So you were familiar with Reed College. Is that the only institution that you applied to then?
I don't think so. I think I applied to one or two of the UC campuses too, but I didn't go there, obviously, but mm-hmm. I can't remember whether I got in. I think I got in, but I'm not positive on that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In terms of paying for college, was that something that your parents were going to support? You'd mentioned that your
mom
worked extra hours to
help.
Yeah, my
mom was a big player in that.
Okay.
There's a big factor.
And let's see, your sister, she's 13 months older.
Oh, that's a different
story. Oh, that's it, sorry.
Kate was right behind Jack.
Kate was,
what,
5 years old.
5 years older than me.
5 years.
5 years old. Okay, so.
She's the one who had to read.
Yeah.
Okay.
Shelley was the one that was adopted. She went to community college, I think. Huh?
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So you saw Reed when you were still in. Let me start again. So I was asking the question because I thought that you might have overlapped with your sister at Reed, but I guess by the time you started there, she had already graduated.
Didn't she transfer to Lewis and Clark?
Well, she actually started at Lewis and Clark.
Yeah, she started at Lewis and Clark.
And then
but she
and
had graduated by the time Reed went there.
Okay.
She finished in 67, and you started there in 68.
68.
They almost overlapped.
Okay. So can you tell me a little bit about what it was like starting college for you? Is this the first time that you were living away from home for an extended period of time?
Yeah, it would have been.
What was that transition like for you?
That was fine. I loved the freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Not having an answer to my parents was delightful. I liked the chance to meet, they were called Reedies.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting people, various levels of sanity among them, but all of them had something to offer, you know, in an interesting way.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I was glad to be at a school that I thought was a good school to be attending.
Mm-hmm. When you started there, do you recall generally how many students were in your entering class?
Oh, maybe 100.
100. So it's a relatively small college. Okay. Were the individuals that went to Reed College, were they relatively local to the Northwest or to the West Coast?
Only a small fraction. They kind of stood out, the ones that lived in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
And were there. They weren't ostracized or anything like that, but you definitely knew that they were from Portland.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause not very much of the school was from Portland.
Mm-hmm.
They were mostly from other places.
You said mostly the East Coast.
Yeah, mostly East Coast.
So mostly people from the East Coast,
right,
coming to the West Coast.
Right.
Did you find the students from the East Coast culturally different in any way?
Indeed.
How so?
To be blunt, they were so rude. I was amazed,
mm-hmm,
that people would be that rude to other people in a lot of instances. Mm. But
do you recall any specific examples?
No, just in general that they had a pretty, I don't know if this is what I should be talking about, but they had a strong, they were better than the West Coasters,
mm-hmm,
attitude. So, and they weren't hesitant to relay that.
I think a lot of them were wealthy and the kids had gone to very private, wealthy high schools.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, he was pretty middle class.
And I hardly knew, I don't think I knew anybody that had gone to a private school at that point.
Yeah, they'd gone to premier high schools. And
they
were somewhat wealthy.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I interacted with some of those
students.
I was not one of those students,
yes,
but I did interact with those.
East side.
Yeah. And what was your course load like when you entered Reed? How many classes were you taking? Types of classes?
It was a full load, so whatever the core, you know, the number was for that.
Mm-hmm. And do you remember what subjects you started taking when you?
Started taking philosophy, started off with that,
mm-hmm,
then switched to biology as I got more interested in the medical stuff.
So philosophy as a major and then switching to biology,
right,
as a major?
Exactly.
What were the college classes like for you compared to what you were experiencing in high school? More challenging, different topics? Were the teachers, the professors there moving you in different directions. What was the educational pedagogy like?
Yeah, well, the intensity was probably the biggest difference in how much work was involved in getting what you were supposed to get done. So it's a pretty demanding school as far as what they require from the students. And I really was, I guess, not taken aback by it, but I guess I wasn't really expecting that much rigor going into it, but you adjust to it. So it worked out.
With the full course load, you'd mentioned that in high school you were working, right? You had jobs. Were you also working during college?
No.
No?
No. So my mom's working and couldn't collect enough money to send us to college, so didn't have to do that.
Okay.
Later on, I did some at the local newspaper because I knew the newspaper business pretty good. Working in the summer and stuff like that to save up money. So as I progressed through college, I got through, I think, if I remember correctly, a four-year standard deal. And I didn't feel that my mom should be paying any more money. So I worked until I could save up enough money to finish that last year.
When you were taking your classes, you mentioned that there was an intensity to them in terms of what was required to get the work done. Did you have time for any other activities when you weren't in class, when you weren't studying?
Took karate classes, which I enjoyed those. That was pretty fun.
Was that something, had you taken karate before?
Never.
Didn't
even know really what it was until I got there. But my room had roommates who had taken karate, so they got me started at it.
And any other interests? Were you still going out hunting occasionally, fishing?
No.
You did calligraphy.
Oh, I did calligraphy. So there was, the school was pretty, had a pretty strong footprint in calligraphy. Had a guy that was pretty famous. There's classes in it that I took. I took, I think, 3 years of calligraphy over the course of the school.
Do you know what sparked your interest in calligraphy?
Well, my sister could do it, and her writing was so beautiful. I knew I could take the classes there, so I wanted to be able to do it just like she could. I never did get that good, but that was probably what spurred me on.
So you did calligraphy for 3 years. You mentioned you decided to switch from philosophy to biology. Was that switch from philosophy to biology in your first year, or is that something that you did as you progressed?
I think that was in the second, or it wasn't in the very first.
Okay, so not the first year.
Yeah, not
maybe really the second year or slightly thereafter.
I'm not sure exactly, but it wasn't right away.
And you were still interested in pursuing medicine?
Yes.
As a career?
Mm-hmm.
When you moved into the biology major, do you recall what the department required in terms of core courses that you needed to take for your degree, and what, I don't know if it was these were referred to this way at the time, but distribution credits, like courses in other departments?
Oh, yeah. There was a list of required courses. It wasn't overwhelming. There still was a fair amount of room left for you to take courses outside of the department.
Okay.
So, but you had to tick off the required courses.
So one of those classes was calligraphy. Do you recall some of the other classes that you were interested in taking in college?
Oh, wow, it's been so long on that. I don't know, maybe nothing bounces into the...
I mean, I took a fair number of courses. I couldn't tell you. I'd have to look at my transcript.
Yeah.
I just didn't know if maybe you had like an underlying interest in war, the history of warfare. So maybe you were taking classes on the history of war or anything that, but just general courses.
Yeah. I was conscientious objector. Mm-hmm. So,
All right, so that was a bad example for me, but yeah.
Well, one of the things I think you took up too is gardening. You started a vegetable garden.
Oh, really?
Right.
And a quite large, elaborate. I've only seen a couple of pictures. I didn't know him then.
He was a few times the size of this room.
Wow. And so how did that start?
Just got interested in gardening. So.
And he lived in an old Victorian-style house that had a pretty big yard. Mm-hmm. So he had the space to do it.
Yeah.
And so you were, there wasn't on-campus housing for students at Reed?
First year,
and then after that you're on your own.
After that, I think you could get on campus if you wanted, but nobody that was in their right mind wanted to go back to on-campus housing.
And so living off campus, in addition to taking your classes, you mentioned a garden, you had other responsibilities then, right? Like you needed to eat, so you had to cook. You needed to do laundry. You needed, and if you were in a house, I don't know if someone was maintaining the house for you or if you had responsibilities for repair. Like what other things were occupying your time on sort of that level while you were in college? And was it difficult for you to, you know, to become an adult in a certain sense?
No, did a lot of the karate stuff. So that filled, and some of the other guys that lived in the house were doing karate too. Mm-hmm. So we all kind of had that in common. And had the big yard, and I was into this gardening. Mm-hmm. So that took up any free time after doing the schoolwork, but mostly focused on getting the classwork and, for lack of a better term, homework done.
And his cooking, he had it down to, because money was tight, what was it, about a dollar a day with rice, eggs.
Yeah, and eggs. Two pieces of sausage. Hmm.
I lived on ramen for quite some time.
Exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and a friend made me start buying eggs, so it's like, you need a little protein, like, put the egg in there. It's like, all right, fine. All right. So ramen and eggs was a staple for me for quite some time.
Yeah.
The garden that you started, was this a food garden or just okay? So what types of foods?
Corn,
were you?
A lot of corn, because that was easy to cook.
Right. Delicious corn.
So yeah.
You would eat it fresh. We would eat it fresh.
We'd eat as much corn as we could. I'd way over plant, so we could eat as much as we wanted during the corn season.
Pumpkin, didn't you grow a big pumpkin?
Yeah, I could pumpkin just to see how big a one I could grow.
How did you learn to do the gardening?
Mostly trial and error, actually. Mm-hmm. Didn't have anybody that was knowledgeable about it to show me.
Did Pete ever, or Dad, his nickname was Pete, did he ever show you gardening, or did
I don't
he
think
ever?
So. I can't remember.
So at 8 Howard Hill, he had a little garden with corn and tomatoes and sugar and stuff.
Yeah, I don't remember that.
Yeah.
If he did.
Okay. So as you're pursuing your degree in biology, you're taking classes, you had been thinking about becoming a doctor. I do know that you wind up going on to graduate school, but not medical school.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious to know at what point in your college career your thinking about becoming a physician changes, and why.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's an interesting question.
What was the article you read in the paper?
Oh, why don't you refresh my memory?
Remember about the children?
Oh, about the children starving to death? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I happened to see an article in the Oregon Daily newspaper on a Sunday morning, and it talked about how many kids were dying from lack of food. Mm-hmm. So at that point, that was actually the switch flip. I said, oh, that can't be ignored. So got involved in that. mm-hmm. from that standpoint. Wanted to help produce food.
Do you recall what year in college?
It's probably about 260.
Maybe
68.
You graduated in 68, so it had to have been the year, either 60, 1 or 2 years before that, because you had to take plant classes.
Oh,
but
yeah.
At Reed, they only had like one.
It was probably
63
or something.
No. You graduated from high school.
High school.
Yeah.
He graduated from Reed in 74, I thought, right?
He started at Davis in 74, January of 75.
Right.
No, or 74. Oh, shoot. Yeah. let me think about it.
So, I mean,
yeah,
it would have been 68. Like, you were 18 when you started
college.
Yeah. Right.
So that would be 68. And so receiving the degree, you think, is more...
It did college in 5 years.
So it took 5 years because you switched your major?
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah. So switching your major, then you needed to take different classes.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
And he probably switched, I would guess, maybe year three.
Yeah.
If I was to guess.
Yeah.
70, 71.
And this is also why you wanted to make money, because you were to pay for your last year of college, because you were actually staying for 5 instead of for 4.
Right.
Yeah, January 74 is when he started at Davis.
Okay.
Okay.
January 74. Thank you. So you read this article, you decide not to pursue medicine, but you wanted to change your career path in order to address this problem. Right. I know that you received a BS in biology from Reed.
Right.
That's correct. So you mentioned that you needed to, you stayed a fifth year to complete your degree. What courses did you need to take at Reed in order to shift in the direction that you wanted to do for your new career?
Well, I'd been taking more of the social studies type courses
mm-hmm.
before I made that switch. So I had all the chemistry, and I don't know if I had a physics class, more scientifically oriented coursework.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to do a
project.
A project.
Senior project.
Senior project. And you did it on... chlorophyll? It was algae.
It was done with algae. But I can't remember what the project was focused on.
So with this decision to switch career trajectories...
Yes.
I'm trying to think of how to formulate this question, so I apologize if
That's
a bit cumbersome. When we think of established professions like becoming physicians or engineers,
mm-hmm.
usually there's like a straightforward path to mm-hmm. achieving those, right? You go to medical school, you get an engineering degree. Since you wanted to change what it is that you did or what your career was going to be,
mm-hmm.
how did you learn what you needed to do? How did you learn what steps you needed to take in order to pursue this new career path?
Oh, that's a good question. I guess I just looked up what the required coursework was
mm-hmm.
In the alternate availability.
How did you find out about UC Davis? I didn't meet him until he got to UC
yeah,
Davis.
Right.
How did you find out about UC Davis? I mean, it was an ag school.
It's an ag school. And that went along with what I wanted to do as far as helping to feed people.
Hmm. Were you aware, or had you known anyone who had pursued a PhD?
Kate, maybe?
Well, Kate was working on hers.
But she, yeah. I don't know if she had actually...
She actually went to law school, stopped, and then she started working on a PhD.
So that concept existed as, like, for these advanced degrees.
Yeah.
I know when I was going for my advanced degree, my mother had a lot of doubts or...
Yeah.
Because it's not something that she experienced growing up, right? Like, maybe you went to college, but more college, right? That concept didn't necessarily make sense. And so I was wondering if you had been introduced to anyone or if other people from Reed College had decided to pursue PhDs, or if the professors there, when you maybe you spoke to them about your interests, were they saying, yeah, you need to go and get a PhD in order to do what it is you wanted to pursue?
Yeah, I don't recall that taking place.
Okay.
I think for whatever reason, I just thought I would, that was necessary for me to do.
And when you were thinking about this new career path, it's not uncommon for people to pursue a PhD and want to work at a university, right?
Right.
Do you recall thinking along those lines that you wanted to become a professor in order to educate? Did you want to become a professor so that way you could do research? Do you recall what it was at that time that you were thinking you'd like to do once you completed this next step, getting this advanced degree?
Yeah, I think I wanted to be able to do research.
Okay. So you wanted a research position, and were you thinking that that was something you could only do at an academic institution, or were you aware of any private companies that you could do that type of research?
For whatever reason, didn't even really look into private companies. I just kind of assumed it involved education.
Do you recall what the application process was like for graduate school for you? I know you went to Davis. Had you looked at, do you recall looking at any other schools potentially to pursue the degree?
I don't think I applied any place other than Davis.
Yeah, he showed up one day and that's when I met him, so I don't know what his process was before.
Yeah, I think I just applied to Davis.
Okay.
But I think somehow you heard about, learning about agriculture, and I don't know how you found out about Davis, and then how you met Bill Raines. He was
our major professor.
And he had funding to bring Tim in as a graduate student.
Okay. So somehow interacted with Bill Raines, and so when you were applying to graduate school, you already had a professor to work with?
Already knew that I wanted to work with him, yes.
Okay. You're wrapping up your college degree, right, and resettled on 74, you started Davis at the beginning of 74. What was it like for you to move to Davis to begin pursuing your graduate degree? Was there anyone else from Reed that was going to Davis?
Not that I knew.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how was it moving back to California?
It was delightful. I didn't realize that professors could be so nice. I just had this mindset of, this is how higher education is. It's torture, of sorts, and here was a place where people were happy. They're doing something that definitely is of value. They aren't worried. It's not who can one-up another person by saying something smart, ass, for lack of a different term, in their conversations with them and stuff like that. So it was just a delightful change in environment.
Okay. I remember him saying that at Reed, you didn't dare ask a question unless you knew the answer, and everybody was very strict.
Because the professor would actually make fun of you.
And oh, wow.
When he got to Davis, he was sitting in a classroom, everybody's raising their hands.
And I shrank in my seat, literally like this. I thought, oh, my God. Actually, in this case, There was just one other guy who was sitting next to me, and I did not want to be sitting next to the guy that was about to get rung over the coals. Because he went, wait a minute, I have a question. And Reed, they would dissect him for doing that.
Wow, okay. When you started at Davis, what department were you actually in at Davis?
Agronomy.
So it was the agronomy department?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
How large was the department in terms of both the faculty and also the other graduate students there?
Well, that's where I met Sue. So
it was a pretty well-known internationally department, the agronomy department, and it had a lot of basic agricultural in terms of, you know, planting, row crops and breeding, and a lot of the what's the correct word, you know, the standard producing crops and maximizing yields and stuff like that. Davis was a really cool campus because you had the agronomy department, and then you had other departments, soils and stuff like that, that specializes in insects and, you know, other weed problems and stuff like that. But the agronomy department was kind of agriculture, and this is when all the biotech stuff was just
coming on,
onto the scene. So it was where you have traditional agriculture, now all of a sudden you have these weird biotech people coming in and, you know, kind of thing. So there was a little bit of the traditional clashing with the non-traditional approaches to agriculture. Mm-hmm. That was happening right at that point.
Yeah.
And so you were already in the...
I was working my way through college, so I was a technician in the lab. And they had just started what was called the Plant Growth Center. So they had faculty from
different departments,
and they kind of put them together, and it was starting to do some of what plant cell culture, recombinant DNA was just kind of being discovered and thought. And then there was a lot of work done on trying to make plants be able to fix nitrogen, taking traits from legumes and putting them into agricultural crops and seeing if we can, you know.
Like soybeans. Yeah.
Peanuts too. So there was a lot of cutting edge stuff creeping into the traditional agriculture at the time. And Bill Raines was one of the founding people of
that. Hi, you were not with?
He went to find you.
He went
to
find
you. So Bill Raines, who did a lot of interesting traditional stuff, was just starting to get started in this and had hired me to start his plant cell culture work. And then that's when Tim also then. I had started, I guess, was it?
About a year before.
About a year before. And then,
yeah.
Okay. And how many individuals were working with and for Bill?
Ooh, he had a lot of students at the time, and they were doing more traditional, you know, agricultural research on nitrogen, and he had postdocs, he had quite a crew.
Yeah.
Would you say, like, is this like 10, 20,
yeah,
50?
Yeah, I would say like 10.
10 individuals.
We had a pretty active lab. Mm-hmm. There was people
there
doing...
There was two professors that shared a lab.
Right.
So we had about, all together, probably 15 people in there.
And, yeah. And then there was... they were doing a lot of modeling at the time. They were trying to, you know, measure, like, and come up with computer programs to, you know, if you tweak this, will you get, you know, higher yields or whatever? And so there was that component to the lab. Mm-hmm. And then I was kind of... the only technician, and then I would oversee the, like, student workers and all that.
And when you say student workers, do you mean undergraduate or?
Yes.
Okay.
Right. I myself was an undergraduate, but I was the
senior.
I was the head technician. And okay. then the student workers would come in and wash dishes, or they would do measure things or something. We would give them tasks to do.
And you mentioned that Bill hired you as the technician. Had you worked in similar labs previously?
So when I was in high school, I knew I wanted to go to college and try to make money, and I got a job working at Salk Institute mm-hmm. doing animal cell culture.
Okay.
And I just fell in love with that. Mm-hmm. And I was, I had a really good person that I worked for, and he involved me in a lot of the research and actually put my name on publication. So when I got to Davis, I walked around knocking on doors trying to find a job, and most incoming jobs into a lab was washing dishes. And I would walk around with my published paper saying, I know how to do animal cell culture, but I wanted to work in plants. I went to other labs too, but I ended up, I met Bill, and that's how I got the job there, because they wanted to start doing plant cell culture, and they thought, oh, well, yeah. She knew sterile technique already, and all that. So.
I'm familiar with graduate programs that train people in chemistry, in biomedical science, and those areas. But I don't think I've interviewed anyone who has focused on agronomy and those types, mm-hmm. And those related sciences. Can you tell me a little bit about what the structure of the graduate program was like in terms of classes that you needed to take? Did you have to serve as a teaching assistant? What is that type of lab like? I know I've just given you like several questions all at once. Yeah. I'm just giving you a general idea of what right. I want to ask about. Like, let's just start with, you know, what was the curriculum like for graduate school classes?
Yeah, I had to take a lot of classes. You probably have taken some of those. As an undergrad?
I was an undergrad botany major, and I took every plant course I could. Where yeah. Tim was coming in as a master's student in agronomy,
right.
but he didn't have any of the basic plant classes, so
courses.
He had to take a lot of undergraduate classes to catch up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, so we actually overlapped a little bit. And, you know, I was taking the courses, but he had to kind of fulfill his master's
requirement.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a common thing or an uncommon thing for graduate students coming into that program?
Kind of a mixed bag,
I
think, yeah. People coming in at that time to get a master's in agronomy, there was a whole range of people, and, you know, people were interested in organic farming and, you know, a lot of kind of, you know, they were coming in with no knowledge of plants and how plants work, or farming and how farming worked. And there was kind of a range of...
Yeah, I ran the spectrum.
And at Davis, you could be very traditional and agronomy. You could do ecology. You could do plant physiology. So depending on kind of at what level you wanted to, whether you wanted to go out and help the farmers or whether you wanted to do basic plant research as to kind of... You know,
in the lab.
Range.
So there were the courses that you had to take. Did you, when you first started there, were you put to work in Range's lab as well?
Yeah.
We started doing the
cell culture
work.
Okay.
Yes.
And so was this an assigned project from Range, or was this something that let his students have? Pursue their own interests as long as they aligned with the mission of the lab.
That was pretty assigned, I think.
He wanted
salt tolerance.
Yes, yeah, so salinity, salt tolerance.
Resistance to salt in the soil
mm-hmm.
and water.
And so this was such at the beginning that people were just learning how to make plant cells grow and then how to regenerate a plant back from the cells. So we had to develop... you know, some of those basic techniques. And then the work became, he was interested in salt tolerance. So we developed a cell line that was tolerant to salt versus not, and would do comparisons between the two. the tolerant, non-tolerant.
To study.
At the cellular level.
Yeah, study how I did that at the cellular level.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about how you developed those? Like, what is the process that one goes through to develop these cell lines that are more resistant to salinity?
So you take, when you made the media, culture media that the cells would be grown on, you could put in, you know, the standard series of, there's about 20 ingredients you put in,
mm-hmm.
that they need to flourish. And then in addition, you could add salt. And so you could, then you had a range of activities you could do with something that was exposed to that salt level in the growth medium.
Mm-hmm.
So what we were looking for was things that were resistant to salt and would tolerate, correct me if you disagree, and would tolerate the presence of salt in fields. In California especially, there's a lot of fields that are pretty seriously contaminated with salt just because of the evaporation of the water over time.
Mm-hmm.
The water evaporates, the salt's left behind, and it accumulates. So it was affecting the crops that the farmers were trying to grow.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea was to try to develop in the laboratory plants that would survive being exposed to a lot of salt in their surroundings, for lack of a better term, in the culture media,
mm-hmm.
And work from there to develop the new plants for the farmers to grow.
So I think the mm-hmm. ultimate goal was to take a plant, rice and alfalfa, over two that we worked with, develop the cell culture, develop a salt-tolerant cell line, and then take that cell line and regenerate a plant and hope that that plant would be salt-tolerant, that
mm-hmm.
you could then grow in a crop. In doing that, we also did some more basic science in terms of
energy consumption,
what it costs the cell to deal with salt, and regulation of sodium and potassium and you know, some other little basic things like that.
Mm-hmm. And so when you were doing these early experiments, were, like, I know there are standard model organisms in biological sciences. Was there a standard cell line that you were working with that you were hoping would change with different exposures and then like keep cultivating that changing cell line? Or were you like, well, okay, there's this one cell line, let's see how that cell line responds to this. Then here's another cell line and it's slightly different. Like, let's see how that cell line responds to it. And then another, like, was it looking at what was out there and trying to figure what survived, or was it trying to push something into surviving by modifying the how it was growing and the solutions that was growing in?
Yeah.
It was finding. Right.
Finding. So just looking for the optimal cell line.
And back then, a lot of people did work with tobacco because somebody had worked out where you could regenerate tobacco plants very easily.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for Bill, he was, let's work on crops that are, you know, important crops. Alfalfa is important in California. They grow a lot of it down in the Imperial Valley, and that's where they were having a lot of salt issues. And then, of course, rice is very important in terms of a crop. So I think that's kind of how we approached. But those, the correct media to grow cells and get them to regenerate, you know, we kind of had to work on that a little bit, tweak that as we went along. But.
So Sue, you mentioned that you had some experience with animal cultures. Tim, did you have any experience working with any types of cultures while you were an undergraduate, or was this completely new?
New, brand new.
So how did you go about learning the techniques to undertake this work?
Well, they have recipes for what to put into the material that's going to go in the petri dish,
mm-hmm.
but that you're going to grow the tissues on. So you just followed the recipe to make that. If you wanted to expose it into salt, you'd add salt in that medium mm-hmm. as an additional component and do your study with in the presence of salt, or in, you have a control which has no salt for comparison. So what was the other part of the question?
So I was just wondering how you learned to do these techniques. You mentioned that there were recipes.
Yeah, exactly.
But I'm assuming you also needed...
hands-on.
Well, I mean, hands-on, but also techniques to analyze the, mm-hmm. the cultures that you're developing to see how they were thriving or failing or what was going on. And I'm curious to know what sort of... how you went about learning how to do that analysis if you hadn't done it before.
Yeah. What do you think? Just practice? And
well, yeah, I mean, I had already established some techniques and then, yeah. you know, came in and...
So you could, like, grow the tissues on these, in these dishes, petri dishes, that the media contained salt or whatever else mm-hmm. you wanted to study. And then you'd usually use weight as the factor, how fast they were growing.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd have a control that had no salt, and you could use that for comparison for anything that had salt in the experiment. So it's mostly done by weight, if that's the answer
and
to your question.
Phil Raines had not done any plant cell culture, so he didn't have, his training was not in that. But Bill Raines was an extremely sharp individual.
Yeah,
and
great
we
guy.
Would, there were a lot of, so we were located in the agronomy department, but across the street in another building was where most of the people doing plant cell culture were. And we would regularly have meetings and we'd get together and consult with each other and get advice. And I think Tim and I kind of worked hand in hand with a lot of it, and then we got with Bill, and we would have meetings, and every once in a while we got to, you know, something that wasn't working, you know, we'd sit around and talk about it, and of course reading the literature about what other people are doing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a lot of trial and error.
Mm-hmm. And so developing these techniques took time, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is not a lab that had been doing this for long periods of time, so it's mm-hmm. kind of brand new to everyone. You mentioned that there are other people at the university that are that might be more familiar with it, so picking up some of the techniques from those individuals. During this period of time when you're beginning this type of laboratory work, it's early in your graduate career,
mm-hmm.
right? What was the overall long-term plan for, maybe I shouldn't phrase it as long-term plan, what was the overall structure of the graduate program in terms of starting to getting your MS to getting your PhD? What were the steps, in addition to taking classes, what were the steps required of you in order to make your way through the program?
Well, in conference with a major professor, you would come up with a research plan.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to have some specific question you were going to ask.
Mm.
So, for example, if you're working with salt, one question you could ask is, could plants perhaps mutate at the cellular level mm. in dishes that contain gelatin and nutrients, but which also contains salt, and could you isolate from those tissues, those pieces of tissue, ones that were resistant to salt by their growth
mm-hmm.
or by their weight. So,
so his master's was, so he had to take courses, and then he had to do a research project and write up a thesis,
mm-hmm.
and what was the name of your, I wrote it down so I wouldn't forget, but you did the study between the two cell lines, the salt tolerant
right.
and non-salt tolerant, in terms of potassium content, sodium content, and you know, all that kind of stuff. So that was your... your master's.
Was that a project that you, was that something that Bill Rain said, I need someone to work on this, are you interested in it? Or was that an idea that you had and you brought to Rain's as a possibility?
I think that was already in the works, in the laboratory.
So this was more of a project that you were assigned.
Yes.
To develop data from.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about what it was like working in the lab? You mentioned, you know, the number of individuals. There, it was a kind of a shared space, right? There were two professors who were in close proximity working in these labs. What were your days like? Were you getting in at 8 in the morning and leaving at 8 at night? What were you doing in the lab? Was there just a lot of sitting and waiting around for things to grow? Can you tell me a little bit about what, like, the day-to-day work
was
like?
Yeah, you do several of those stages that you just mentioned not in sequence, at the same time. So you'd start a cell line, for example, and you'd set that in an incubator and let it start to flourish.
Mm-hmm.
And while it's flourishing, you might start another cell line where you included salt in the media, and you put the same amount of material, or take some from that cell line that you're growing in the incubator, take some tissue out of that, put it on in the presence of salt now, close that up, put it in the incubator. So a lot of it is like weighing things.
Mm-hmm.
That's the main parameter you use to measure growth at the cellular level.
Yeah. But a daily basis, you know, you come into work, you would prepare your media, autoclave things, transfer tissue to fresh media because you had to constantly be feeding them, design an experiment, and we wanted to do grow cells in a liquid culture, and we needed a shaker, so built a shaker, a two-tiered shaker thing. So part of it was going down to, turned out to be a very good friend of ours, Dave Page. He was a person in the department who, basically, he was he still is a very extremely bright individual, and
yeah.
He'd come in and you'd say, I need to measure something, you know, and he would come up with a machine to do it, or, you know, we needed a shaker, he would kind of design it, and okay, drill these and do this, and he would help you build things. And so on a daily basis, and then we would have meetings, you'd go to class, and then there was a real good camaraderie. There was a real good group within the department. Had coffee breaks that would meet up. And then there was a lot of us that were, you know, young and single, and after work, go down to a local bar and have beers together, and, you know, just would hang out. And then we started where on Fridays we would meet in this kind of grassy area, and play volleyball together and stuff like that. So there was always the controversy between the traditional people there getting, you know, their PhDs in agriculture and us playing around with our cells, you know. But
there was no friction.
But we would still get together, and, you know, we had a good camaraderie.
Yeah.
Despite our, you know, that's a waste of time, you know, kind of thing, and all that. So some of the older professors were, you know, kind of, you know, what are they doing? Kind of.
Yeah, our fellow students never criticized us at all, zero. They were on board with what we were doing.
Were you still sporting the long hair in graduate school, or had that?
No.
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 Cut that off?
Yeah. Longish hair, but not, no.
No ponytail.
No ponytail. How many hours would you spend in the lab each day? Was it a 9 to 5?
For Tim? Kind of. he was a graduate student, so he had a lot more flexibility. He was really only required to be there for like 20 hours, and then of course you had coursework and stuff like that. For me, it was a little different. It was my job.
Right.
So, that was
yeah, you
different.
Start at 8.
Actually, I would get there early because I would have to then leave for classes.
Yeah.
So I was trying to get my hours in to for
right.
work, and then I
that's
would
true.
Leave in the middle of the day, go to class, and come back and work.
And so how many projects did you wind up undertaking in Raines' lab during your tenure there?
Ooh. How many do you think?
I mean, I don't know how long any one of these projects would normally take.
Would grow on themselves.
Yeah.
So, you know, we came up with a line of alfalfa cells that were salt tolerant. And so we would do some basic studies, but then at the same time, I was working on trying to get them to regenerate into a plant. Well, we finally got that happening. And so then we were babying all these little plants that we were getting, and then we finally got a whole bunch of these plants. And then we had to do, remember in the greenhouse, we would set up and make cuttings from them and grow them and try to do experiments with the plants at different salt levels to see if we actually came up with a salt tolerant alfalfa plant, which we did not.
Pretty tedious.
So there was a lot of things. And then it was an interesting lab too, because if somebody had a big project, I remember Ed Ng, he would do these modeling studies, and so he would come in and he would just have tons of plant samples that had to be, you know, get leak
tested.
Areas, and, you know, so everybody would just kind of, okay, you know, here's the day everybody's going to join in and help Ed do his thing or whatever. So, but
there's a lot of camaraderie in a lab. People would pitch in, you know.
But it was definitely not 8 to 5. It was, you kind of stayed when you had to, and if you didn't, you could leave.
Yeah.
And you mentioned some of the things that you were doing when you weren't in the lab. Did you have other interests that you were pursuing while you were at Davis?
So he still had his garden.
I still had my garden.
Or it was a new garden.
Yeah.
But I had a bigger project.
So Dave Page, this very good friend, wine making became a thing.
A hobby of ours.
And so there was Bill Raines, Dave Page, and Tim and I. And I guess Ed Ng helped some
to some extent, yeah.
And we would go to Napa, and there was a UC Davis research facility there. And after the professors would go through and pull all their grapes, we could go in and harvest the grapes, and then we took them back to the
harvest what was left.
Wine.
So we'd go back and make wine from it.
And Dave Page and Bill Raines both dug cellars in their backyards.
Yeah, that's sort of the two bosses there.
Yeah. So.
So winemaking.
Winemaking.
One activity. The garden.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And then towards a little bit later, Dave and Tim got into beer making and decided to open a beer brewery in Davis. But at that time, the law was such that if you made beer in a facility, people could come in and drink the beer and you could sell it there. But you couldn't retail, you couldn't sell your beer at another store. Like wineries could. You could go in and taste wines and stuff like that and drink, and you could go to a store and buy the wine. But the law was you couldn't do that for beer. And this was in the early 70s, mid 70s. And so basically, they bought a bar, started the process, had a brew kettle made.
Brew kettle, right.
Big copper kettle.
In San Francisco.
And kind of started this whole process. And then Dave Page got together with this guy, and they got the law changed. But by then, Tim was finishing his PhD and going off to Louisiana. And then it just. Now that's why you have beer places everywhere that.
In California, anyway.
You can brew and sell.
Made it legal.
That's impressive, getting the law changed.
Yeah.
Earlier, you had mentioned that the time that you were at Davis, this was also the beginning of the rise of biotechnology. Right. So people interested in modifying genomes, genetic material, doing lots of other sorts of work with that. Were you, how did you, at the time, were you aware of this biotechnology work going on, or is this something that you realized was going on while you were, like afterwards, that you realized was going on roughly at the same time that you were at Davis?
At the same time.
At the same time. And so how were you exposed to the individuals that were developing these new biotechnologies and starting these companies? Were they regular? Did they make their appearances on campus? Were they former students from Davis and the surrounding area?
Or? What do you think? We were kind of separated from the heavy-duty gene transfers.
Right. But part of that plant growth lab, there was an individual, Ray Valentine, mm-hmm. and he was big on a lot of that stuff. And he actually started a company at Davis called Plant Genetics, Plant something.
Yeah, we can look it up later.
Yeah. So it was happening. Mm-hmm. You know, you were hearing about it. You go to meetings. Everybody was talking about it. And then that's when genetic engineering and let's make these crop plants do these amazing things. Mm-hmm. And the traditional breeders, you know, were sitting around, that's so much junk. You know, you can't do that. But we're all, we're going to put these genes in these plants and make them wonderful. So it was a hotbed at the time.
You had the traditional plant breeders, which didn't really buy in on it in general. Mm-hmm. I think there was exceptions. Some one or two of them did. Mm-hmm. And then you had the people like us that were working on the other end that were completely buying in mm-hmm. on that.
And so you counted yourself in the group of the biotech people, gene splicing. And, and as you're pursuing your degrees, right, you decided to go into this area because kids were hungry and you thought that was wrong. Mm-hmm. While you're pursuing this work, while you're doing this work and you're pursuing your degree, were you thinking about what your career was going to be once you finished your degree? Like, were you thinking, I want to stay at a university and do research? Or now hearing about these biotech companies, were you thinking, you know what? Hey, I started a brewery, got some laws changed.
Yeah.
I'm going to start a biotech company. Or I want to join a biotech company because they're the ones that are going to make the difference. So I'm wondering, during your graduate school years, when did you start to think about what your next career steps were going to be and what they were going to be?
Well,
so there was a group of us that were all coming along about that same time. And that was a topic. Do you go to these new companies or Monsanto or these established companies, or do you go the academic route? And that would be discussed many times over beers as to, okay, which way are you going to go? What am I thinking and stuff? And we knew individuals who, you know, would go off to Monsanto, and then some vice president over here decided that was done and they'd lose their job like this, you know, and other people were going into academics and, you know, barely making tenure. And, you know, so it was a hard decision.
Pluses and minuses on both sides.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was back and forth in terms of which direction we were going to go, I think. And I think that I guess I want to take back, Tim was becoming more and more interested in rice, and there was the LSU Rice Research Station doing work on rice, and they were interested in getting involved in biotech. And I think somebody who was at Davis had gone to the LSU Rice Research Station. He was a very traditional agronomist. And they were at LSU, they were saying, you know, we're interested in doing this and stuff. And he says, well, I know somebody who's finishing his PhD.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was Marlon.
Marlon Brandon.
Yeah. And I, once that connection was made, I think that path then went that way. But something I think we kind of skipped over, having to do with feeding the children, Tim started a class at Davis. He decided he wanted to expose more people to the world food crisis.
Mm-hmm.
So he established a class. I don't remember the number. Mary was going to look that up for me. And it was called
Agricultural Science and the World Food Crisis.
And the whole thing was to bring in agronomists, bring in social people, economic people, political people, and look at the world food crisis from all the different angles. So the class was set up to where he would get somebody good in that field, and they would come and give a lecture, and there would be, you know, handouts with important points. And the whole class was not, you know, are you going to get an A or B in this, but do you understand what's going on? And the tests were like open book, because the whole point was for everybody to kind of learn the material.
I encourage people to cheat on their tests.
And
you know, I said, get together.
And there'd be,
you know,
150
get together and
students
talk it out.
In these classes. And that went on for, I think it went on several years after you left, but that was something that Tim, you know, he in the back of always wanted to do with this, was the world food crisis.
And so when you say that you started this class, was it an undergraduate class or was it open for graduate
undergraduate
students? Undergraduate class.
Graduate students attended it too.
Mm-hmm. And what was the process at the university for establishing a new class?
Let's see.
That was something you did on your own. You knocked on doors and had to talk to the dean.
Yeah. So I talked to the dean. I talked to the chancellor too.
Mm-hmm.
Talked to the chancellor.
Mm-hmm.
So I made an appointment with him, and I said I want to get these people educated on the food crisis. And I said, and he said yes, and that would also get them educated to other aspects of agriculture. And I said, indeed, yeah, that's what the whole deal. We'd bring in every aspect we could of agriculture. And he says, that sounds like a very interesting idea. I think I can find a little money to help you start that class. So he backed it, which made it possible to start the class. And then we started it, and it was a packed house. We had the largest auditorium.
Mm-hmm.
The largest auditorium on campus got packed full the first day of class.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say it that way. So it was very successful.
Had you taught any classes before that one?
No.
So teaching a class can be complicated.
Yeah.
How did you go about learning how to become an educator?
Well, the way this was structured, the guys I asked to give their, from their perspective, their take on the world food crisis from, you know, what they're specialized in. It might be grapes, might be wheat, might be whatever they worked on. And so they determine what the lecture content was.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just helped manage the, you know, nuts and bolts of having the place available and,
mm-hmm.
you know,
making sure. But you came up with a list of individuals and you would go and get them to
and
come
I'd,
give that.
Yeah, I'd talk to them. I'd convince them to come
mm-hmm.
to join the
And
the effort.
Bill Raines was an excellent mentor.
He
was an excellent teacher, excellent researcher,
very
close friend of ours, other than being our major professor. And he just recently passed, and it was a loss.
Sorry to hear that.
was a good person.
You also mentioned, though, that you had, while they may have been open book exams, there were exams.
Yes. Yes.
Were you grading all the exams?
Yes.
So you did no teaching assistants or anything?
Oh, I had teaching assistants, too.
Okay, yes. You had teaching assistants,
right,
for the course. Were they undergraduates or were they graduate students?
Both.
Both, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Were they from the department or just?
Everybody.
Just
all
everybody.
All over the campus.
So how did you go about teaching the teaching assistants what it is that you expected of them in terms of grading? And other responsibilities for the course.
Would have meetings,
mm-hmm.
And they would have a copy of the test and what the and there was multiple choice,
okay,
on the test, so it wasn't a big essay.
Okay, so it wasn't like writing essays and
right,
interpretation.
Wasn't,
you know what this
exactly.
is a this is an A, this is an A
exactly.
minus. It's either
exactly.
right or wrong.
Right. And
okay.
got the head of the what's it? Neuter? What was
oh, aid, wasn't it? USDA?
Yeah, USAID. I got him to come talk.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a big gun as part of the teaching in the course.
So you mentioned that you were able to go out and convince these individuals to come and give talks.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious to know how you were able to, you're a graduate student.
Right.
I know you're coming from a well-known, you're working with a well-known individual, but you're a graduate student.
Right.
How are you getting these big-name individuals to come? And
I think...
He's a persistent Irishman.
I think when I approached him, it was kind of complimentary,
mm-hmm.
because they were the one that was picked out in their field of expertise. So out, you know, one guy is kind of one guy per department. So I'd go to this guy in this department, get him to say okay. I'd go to this guy in this department, get him to say okay. So got the, I would explain that the chancellor's going to be talking. That was, I think, the breakthrough from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
The chancellor's
yeah, the first
be,
year he did give.
Did the kickoff speech, you know, for the course. And he backed it.
And so when you're asking these individuals to come and give talks after the course was over or after the talks were over, did you remain in contact with these individuals? Did they become a network of sorts?
Not so much. I wouldn't say so. No. How long did we have the class?
Well,
it
after you left, yeah, after you left, I think it went on for several more years. I don't think it's taught anymore.
Yeah.
His sister's provost there now, and she was going to get that information. And
yes, I could ask my sister. She's provost.
Yeah. But, yeah.
And who, I'm sorry to use this word, but it seems appropriate, who took up the reins when you moved on, who took on the course?
Ooh. I think Bill did.
Bill did?
So Reins took the reins?
Yeah.
Reins, Reins took the reins. There we go.
Okay.
Full circle.
Now, one thing that I haven't asked about, and if you're not comfortable discussing it, that's I completely understand. But how did you two happen?
Let's see. Well, worked together, fell in love, and got married. Now I happen to be married before, so. That involved a divorce.
Mm-hmm.
But
was this while you were in college?
While I was in college, right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay. And how long after meeting each other?
When we first met, we didn't particularly care for each other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She didn't like me at all.
Yeah. so it took some time, but we had to work together, and there was a lot to get done and stuff. And I was a tough taskmaster. Things had to be done the correct way. And all
mm-hmm.
that. But I think just we became good friends. I was kind of one of few women in agronomy, and I was kind of one of the guys. And so, you know, after work, we'd go have beers or, you know, whatever, and just became close friends.
And we were working in the equipment. I mean, you're sitting...
We were at a transfer hood like this.
You're sitting closer than this.
Mm-hmm. And working and
inches apart.
And just talking.
For 3 or 4 hours. You
every
know,
day.
And a lot of it was very mundane
tissue.
Work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you're doing the same thing over and over again. And
you can talk in the lab, in the hood. So. Mm-hmm.
And then
talk.
He was, when we'd be in the greenhouse sometimes, it didn't matter what I would say, he would turn it into a song, and he would start singing a song about whatever word it was, you know, and he would go on and on and on. But we just, I don't know, we were really became buddies, you know, kind of helping each other out. And,
it's a good time.
So we met in 74, but we didn't get married until 84.
Okay.
So.
And do you recall when you started dating? How long after meeting?
81. When he left.
Oh, okay.
I mean, we kind of hung out.
Right.
You know, hung out with Dave and Bill and some of the other guys. You know, we hung out. We never dated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, we just, everybody would go hang out.
Go have a beer together.
And then
something like
he
that.
Went off to Louisiana. I went to a meeting I went to a meeting somewhere and I was just working then. I'd gotten my master's and I was just working, and somebody didn't want to talk to me because I didn't have a PhD, and it really upset me. So on my way back from the trip, I stopped in Louisiana to visit him, and I said, "What do you think? Do you think I should get a PhD, you know?" And he said, "Yeah, go for it." So I came back and asked Bill if I could get my PhD, and he said, "Yep." And so I started working on my PhD, but he was in Louisiana, and then I think we just started a kind of a long distance deal.
Yeah.
And then when I finished my PhD in 84.
Then an opening popped up at my job site.
Mm-hmm.
And so she applied for it.
Well, first he flew out.
Yeah, first he flew
and
out to.
We, you know, to visit.
Yeah.
And we went and we're on the Golden Gate Bridge and he proposed.
Oh. Oh.
Irish.
Thank you for sharing that. As you were pursuing your PhD, was there... at what point in your time at Davis did you begin what became your PhD research? Your thesis, the main work for your thesis.
When did I start on?
I think it was just a continuation.
Yeah.
I mean, I think once you were kind of into getting your master's, you wanted to stay and get your PhD.
Yeah, exactly.
And then it just kind of
flowed through. So
there was not
had the same major professor for the PhDs as I did for the master's.
Okay. But the reason I'm asking the question is because, I mean, obviously, at some point, you received the PhD. And so I was wondering how you knew when that point was going to happen. I'm trying to think if that question really makes sense. Again, relating it to some of the other people I've interviewed, like, they had a very specific research project. Started it at one point, they wrapped up the research, they were done, they knew they were going to move on to their career. It kind of sounds like this was just ongoing work. Maybe I'm misinterpreting what I'm hearing.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you know when you were going to have enough? Like, how did you know when you were going to have enough research done that it would be considered a PhD or PhD worthy?
So
that's tough.
You had to have, at that time, you had to have like three distinct projects or three distinct publications or three distinct
right.
things.
Mm-hmm.
And so you kind of chiseled those out.
Yeah, publishable articles.
And so is it a decision that Raines was like, okay, you've done enough, now you're getting your degree?
Right.
Right.
Did you have to, was there a thesis defense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what was, were there other individuals that sat for the, as a committee assessing your work?
Yes.
I think it was five.
Yeah.
Five. And he blew through his, no problem.
And
your
so,
orals.
Yeah.
So they were oral exams? Or?
Yeah, he had an oral exam.
Were there, was there a written component? Was there
that
a bound
was,
thesis?
Yeah, the, yeah, right. There's a bound dissertation. And that was the sticking point, because they, once he was, they wanted him at LSU, they wanted him to show up by a certain date. And he was kind of dragging his feet, getting that last chapter written up and done. And,
not dragging it too bad.
No, and they were like, you better, you know, you have to start, I don't remember what the date was, and it was like, and then it came down to you be here May 1st or you don't have a job kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so towards the end there, it was really
kind of found out the last part.
Yeah, get it written and approved.
And did you actually publish any of the work from?
Did I? Yeah.
Yes.
How many papers?
Ooh. I don't know.
A bunch. Bill was very good about letting us be on a lot of publications, and there was chapters and books. There was quite a few. I mean, I could get that list to you. But,
I mean,
yeah.
We can include that later.
Yeah.
Part of my reason for questioning that is, I mean, scientific publishing or science has a specific style to it, right? There's a very specific way of writing. And I mean, I've read some of what you publish, right? There's this tendency to use the past, passive voice. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Things happen, but no one's actually doing them, right? It's,
yeah.
In some ways,
yeah.
It's magical,
yeah.
Right? Because you're not intervening. This is just the evidence, and you're not trying to insert yourself in that type of in those publications. But being that it is, I would say it's not a way of writing that you might learn in school generally. I'm always curious to know how people learn how to write scientifically.
Yeah.
What were you reading articles? And it's like, okay, I just need to mirror this, and you kind of like...
I think there's a fair amount of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What about Dr. Raines? Did he work with you on writing articles? Did he...
He reviewed everything.
He was really good about, yeah. We would write it, he would review it, we would come back. It wasn't like he did it all and just put our name on it. We did it, but he was very good with constructive criticism. But I think it goes back to UC Davis and some of the courses that we took. Ray Huffaker had a great class where you would, he was assigned so many scientific papers, and you would be in charge of one, and you had to read it and critique it. You know, present it to the class and critique it and stuff. And it was, you know, how do you write a scientific paper? You know,
how do you present a scientific paper?
You know, what are the loopholes? And I think he was really good at, you know, coming up with papers that got published that really shouldn't have been published, when you really get down and dissect what it is they did and the science behind it. It's like, oh, wait, he doesn't have a control for this. He, you know, didn't really replicate that. And I think it's the training at Davis,
But here, a lot of the guys there were on the boards of leading journals, so they were handling papers all the time.
And they encouraged all the students and even me as a technician to go to national meetings.
Right.
And you would
give
meet
talks.
People and give
yeah.
talks and interact, and it was a lot of. I think that was important, you know, going around.